Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSilicast podcast, hosted over at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, October 12th, 2008, and this is show number 173. Well, I have a little safety tip for you today. The next time you're toying with the idea of putting hydrogen peroxide in your eye, I'd like to highly recommend against it. See, I did it on Saturday accidentally, and it was not in the least bit a pleasant experience. So the problem is, I have this contact lens solution that you put in a little cup that has a metal disc. The hydrogen peroxide reacts with the metal disc and bubbles all the icky stuff off your lenses. It has a bright red tip to let you know not to put it in your eye, and a bright red ring of cardboard around it, around the end, also to grab your attention. I also have some benign saline solution that is intended for short-term storage while you give your eyes a rest. It does a nice job of rehydrating your lenses. Well, you can probably guess what happened. I grabbed the wrong one, took a nap, and afterwards put what felt like molten lava in my eye. 3 hours later, after a trip to the emergency room, where Steve stayed with me every step of the way, the doctor said I did very minor damage to my cornea and should be okay in a few days. I sure wish he'd sent me home with some soothing eye drops or at least a really cool eye patch so I could talk like a pirate or something. But no, I'm just sitting around all weekend feeling like someone's rubbing a towel directly on my eye. I decided to spare the audience a good look at my eye, so I didn't do a live show this week. You know, I miss it. Since they didn't give me an eye patch, I decided to forego it. It's kind of lonely, though, recording all by myself without the chatter in the background and somebody, Lee, reminding me to save and all that kind of thing, and people yelling, "You made a mistake! You made a mistake!" Well, thanks also to all my Twitter friends who wrote with their well wishes for my recovery. It was very comforting to know that people do care. I was a little worried that my eye wouldn't hold out long enough to write much for the show, so I gave Bart full rein to go long on chit-chat across the pond, and we did. Every once in a while, I like to do a segment on why freeware and shareware is so cool. If you had a problem with an Apple product, say iMovie 08 isn't doing chapter markers for you, for example, what are you going to do? How about when you finally get a tip that GarageBand won't save your file at all if you name it with more than 32 characters, even though it pretends to? You going to write Apple an email telling them to fix it? Call them? Oh yeah, right. With big fat commercial software, and I'm just picking on Apple as an example, but none of the big companies can possibly have the agility and ability to respond to you the way small freeware and shareware companies can. This week's example is about the great company Plask, makers of the indispensable software Sketch. If you're on a Mac and you're not running Sketch, go over to plask.com/Sketch, and that's P-L-A-S-Q. Go over there immediately while you're listening and download it. This software is the best screen capture tool I've ever used, bar none, and I've used a lot of them. The easy snapshots, the easy annotation, the beautiful drop shadows, all the options are marvelous. But everybody already knows that Sketch rocks, but this week I discovered that the developers over at Plask rock too. Out of the blue, I swear I didn't change a thing, Sketch started eating my processors alive. The second I launched it, both processors would peg near to nearly 100%, the machine would heat up, the fans kicked in, and I could have stood all that, but the worst part was that Sketch became unusable. It got so slow, I couldn't even use it. Heck, just the special effects of the way it whooshes out of the way when you hide it would take seconds instead of a split second. If you want to see what I mean, I made a little video of it and posted it over at screencast.com using Jing. I've got a link in the show notes, of course, so you can go see what I was talking about. Well, I switched to another user account, and Sketch was just fine. So that meant it was something I'd done, some conflict between programs, not Sketch's fault. However, I went to the Plask website, and I found this. Quote, "If you have any queries or problems with our products, email us or post on our forum, and we will get back to you as soon as possible. Really?" Unquote. Well, I decided to give them a try. I put all of this in a forum post and I hoped for the best, especially pointing out that I did not have the problem when I was in a second user account. A few hours later, I get an email from Mark at Plask asking me if I could send a process sample from Activity Monitor when Plask was misbehaving. I'm sorry, when Sketch was misbehaving. Well, I shot that off to him, and the next day he sent me a new build of Sketch. Can you believe that? And guess what? It worked. My problem is 100% fixed. I asked him what he found, and they did find a conflict with some other applications that were running. He sent me a later version and asked me to test that too. He must have caught on that I like being a tester. And that later version did not fix the problem. The problem came back. So we're still going back and forth, and I'm having a lot of fun helping him diagnose it and sending files to him and everything. And I just love this, you know? I mean, freeware and shareware companies rock. It's just so fun to get to know the developers and, you know, help each other make the product better. It's just a lot of fun. And I got to recommend Plask for sure. Now, these are the same guys who make Comic Life Magic, Comic Touch for the iPhone, and Doozla for the kids. If you haven't checked this software out, head on over to Plask.com and have some fun and know that you've got a good support staff behind you. Well, are you the kind of person who really likes to help other people with their Macs or PCs? Do you find yourself writing emails with step-by-step instructions on how to do things, complete with screenshots? Or maybe you like to create Word documents to make a manual for a more complex project. If you do find yourself doing this for family and friends, or especially if you find that you do this in your job, you really owe it to yourself to check out ScreenSteps. With ScreenSteps, you'll find that your documentation looks much more professional with far less work on your part. It creates beautiful PDFs, nicely formatted HTML, and even lets you post those lessons to your blog or wiki. I can't get over how many times I find myself using ScreenSteps in my daily life at home or at work. I learned from my friend Gene a long time ago that if the first time someone asks you how to do something, you document it, then someone else will be sure to ask the same question later and you'll already have the document all ready. Needless to say, when I showed Gene ScreenSteps, she was thrilled and got herself a copy. If you're still not sure after hearing my raving praise, click on the ScreenSteps logo in the right-hand sidebar at podfeet.com and download the free 30-day trial and watch the really short video tutorials. You'll really get an idea of how this thing works and how cool it is. Once you're convinced, be sure to use the coupon code NOSILLA, that's my name spelled backwards in all capital letters, to get 25% off. Ivan wrote in with some interesting suggestions of an alternative way to achieve what I talked about last week using Drive-In. Here's what he wrote. On your recent show, you reviewed a program called Drive-In. I would like to give you some information on a free alternative. I had the same problem as you. I wanted to watch DVDs while traveling and at home without having to change discs and have access to the full quality and all the extras on the DVDs. I currently have a Mac Mini hooked up to my 50-inch plasma, and I use the Apple remote to watch all my movies that I have on a network drive. I use a combination of two programs to accomplish this. The two programs are the free OS X built-in Front Row and the free download Mac the Ripper, found at MacTheRipper.org. The first thing I do is I rip my DVDs using Mac the Ripper. Mac the Ripper takes the DVD and makes an exact copy to your hard drive, minus the copy protection. The file created is a video_TS folder, and you can save this anywhere. This folder can be dragged into DVD player, and you have the entire DVD there, all the extras, languages, etc. This is nice. However, if you combine this with Front Row, you get a great experience. Front Row now supports these video_TS folders. Simply place a folder with the movie name and the video_TS folder in your movies folder in Finder. Open Front Row, and under movies, you should see all of your ripped DVDs, and you can play them right from there. To make this more accessible to every Mac and even PC in my house, I put each of the movie folders and the video_TS folder on a network drive. Now, every computer on my network can access these files. When I travel, I just copy the movies I want to my local hard drive, and I have all of the movies I want with me. If the movies are on a network drive, Front Row cannot see the files by default, so within my movies folder, I create an alias to the movie files on the network drive. Front Row can now see all of your movies. No seat licenses to buy, and being compatible with Windows machines makes this a good solution for me. This is of questionable legality, but I own the disc copy of all of the DVDs that I rip, so fair use should come into play. This is no different than what Drive-In appears to do. Love the show and all the product software reviews, Ivan. Well, that sounds like a really interesting alternative, Ivan. I have used Mac the Ripper before, and it does work. I didn't realize that you could play the video_TS folder folder directly into iDVD. That's kind of neat. In some ways, that might be a little bit easier than Drive-In because you have to actually mount the disk image before you can play it in Front Row. The questionable legality issue, I believe technically what you're doing is illegal. I still don't think it's wrong. But my understanding of the DCMA or DCMA, whatever, Digital Copyright Stupid Millennium Copyright Act, is that you're not allowed to reverse engineer the copy protection. And that's exactly what Mac the Ripper does. What Drive-In does is it copies the DVD with the copy protection and adds more copy protection onto it that, in this case, only allows me to play it on five computers because I bought the site license. So I think they accomplished the same objective. By technicality, Drive-In is probably legal and Mac the Ripper is probably illegal. But in both cases, I think it's a perfectly reasonable thing to be able to expect to do. And that's what the fair use law actually said, was you are allowed to make backup copies of things you own. So I think that's a good alternative, and I'm glad you wrote in about it, and I may mess around with that a little bit more now, too. You know, I love the 1-800-DENTIST commercials. Have you seen those? They're really, really funny, the later ones anyway. I love this woman they have talking to the 1-800-DENTIST guy in the elevator. This just cracks me up. So the one they're running right now, she asks him, why on earth would anyone go to the dentist before it was absolutely necessary? He says, well, you wouldn't wait to take your car to the mechanic before it was necessary, would you? And she says, you've made my point exactly. Then she pauses and says, hey, do you know a good mechanic? Well, you know where I'm going with this one, right? I'm yelling at the TV, yes, I know a good mechanic. His name is Honda Bob. He drives right to your house or your job and maintains or repairs your car while you go on about your day uninterrupted. The only drag is there is no Toyota Bob. There's no Mercedes Bob, only Honda Bob. And he only works in the LA or Orange County areas of California. But if you're smart enough to drive in a Honda or an Acura, and you're lucky enough to live in LA or Orange County, then you owe it to your peace of mind and to your car to give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or shoot him an email over at hjabob@aol.com. HJ Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. Well, it's time for another exciting episode of Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from BartB.ie. And I believe BartB.ie is actually up now, isn't it?
Yeah, which is about bloody time. But yeah, it's all up and running. It's all happy. The new server is lightning fast compared to the old one. It's so much fun when I'm, you know, doing stuff on it. You know, I used to have a little script to do backups and stuff, and I'd click the script and it'd churn away for ages. And this one's like, double click, it's done. Hang on, whoa, wait, that can't be right. But it is. It's fantastic.
Well, hot dogs, you know, I only read two blogs. I read your blog and Splash of Style by Debbie T. And so when one of them's gone, I mean, what am I going to read?
Oh, my God, 50% of your blogs have disappeared.
Exactly, overnight. That's not good.
I don't have that high a volume anyway, so I don't think it makes that much odds.
Well, that's why I like to read yours, is it's not a lot of, I don't have to read really often. But you have a pretty important post up this time, and that's what we're going to talk about. Now, we declared security light is what we were going to do, which is you're only allowed to make us worry about security things as long as there's something we can do about it, some actual action we can take. And I believe you have one of those this week.
Yeah, well, actually, before, there's another one that sort of came up after I decided to do this, and that's that Apple have released Security Update 2007-007, I think. 2008-007, there we go.
One would hope.
Yeah, I had a look through the list of bug fixes. It's all the usual stuff. Privilege escalation, arbitrary code execution, denial of service, all the usual pleasantries. So I would suggest updating that as well.
All right, good advice. We always need to know when to do that. What's the other one? The other one's a little more interesting.
The other one's quite a lot more interesting. This one's been bubbling away in the background of the security mailing lists for a while, and it's a name that sort of pops up, and then people go, yeah, but we don't really know about that, and you know, humming and hawing about it. But this week, a proof of concept was released, so no one can argue about its existence anymore. It's real. It's called clickjacking, which is an interesting name. And they haven't released all the technical details, so we don't know exactly how it does what it does. But the basic idea is that using a bit of CSS trickery, they get you to click on one thing, and you think you've clicked on that, but in actual fact, you've clicked on something else that you can't see. Hmm. And so the way you can imagine it is there's a page there, which has links or buttons or whatever, and on a layer above that, but set to be invisible, they have another page or some other content, And when you click, you see the button below what you're actually clicking on. And you don't see that you've clicked on something else in the invisible layer above it.
Hmm.
So this doesn't rely on JavaScript. It only relies on a HTML tag called the iframe, which allows you to embed one page inside another page, and some clever CSS. Well, at least that's how it appears. And the proof of concept is quite interesting because it uses Flash. And you know the way that Flash has access to stuff like your webcam, because you know this from doing Ustream.
Right.
Before you can actually, you know, before you can start broadcasting your stuff, Flash asks you for your permission.
Right. Very politely.
Yeah. And you have to click, yeah, okay, I agree to this. Well, that yeah, okay screen can be hidden in this way. So you can be tricked into turning on your webcam and your mic and sending everything that's going on back to the attacker.
Yuck.
So you basically spy on yourself.
Except luckily with the camera built in on the Macs, a little bright green light's going to go on. You're going to notice.
Yeah, you will notice the bright green light.
Not on the Mac, the mic, though.
You won't notice the mic coming on. And if you're on a PC, you probably don't have that nice bright green light. So you're in a bit more danger there. But it's not just limited to Flash. So it could be anything you can do by clicking can be secretly done in this way.
Hmm.
So most of us have broadband routers, and most of those broadband routers would be configured through an administration web page. So anything that you're logged into, okay, because this happens in your browser, so whatever you're logged into, they can make you click on.
Oh, interesting. Since we get to our routers through a web interface.
Yeah.
Okay.
Then they can reprogram your router that way. Because you're logged into it. The chances are you've clicked the Remember Me button or whatever, so that you don't actually have to log in because you're on your own browser, so it'll just work.
Mm.
Or you might be logged into Facebook, or you might be logged... Anything you're logged into, they could do this too.
Yeah, I don't think there's a Remember Me button on the Linksys router, at least.
Yeah, but Firefox can remember for you.
Yeah, that's true. Haven't done that one since I've had Firefox doing that for me. Okay.
Or your bank.
Yeah, I never click Remember Me on the banks. That just seems like a really bad idea.
It does seem like a really bad idea. But if you happen to already be logged in,
right.
If you have the bank open another tab, then there's absolutely no reason that the attackers couldn't put another copy of your bank in an invisible layer and have you clicking around, you know, transfer money, all that kind of thing.
Okay.
So it's not healthy. There is a small silver lining. It's only what you can do with clicks. So that means that in the bank example, it shouldn't be possible to transfer money because transferring money should require you to type amount into a text box. Should. Unless it uses drop-down menus or something really silly.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Here's the $500 button.
Yeah,
well,
exactly.
Well, you have to type in the account to move it too, also, so...
Well, in my internet banking, the accounts... Actually, yeah, it'd be a drop-down if it was on my bookmarked accounts. So, yeah...
But if if they're trying to get you to transfer money to them, you'd have to type in their account number. So, yeah,
yeah,
that one
exactly.
would be pretty tough. But you can see where this could take you to nefarious... I mean, at the very least, you could suddenly be faced with a nice little porn window that you didn't ask for or something like that.
Yeah, you'd be doing all sorts of horrible things. And... Mm. The more sort of helper stuff within Firefox you might have turned on, like, you know, automatically filling in user details and forms and stuff, mm-hmm. you know, if that's auto-filled in, then the attacker doesn't need you to type anything.
Yeah.
So it's quite a dangerous little thing. Because you can do a lot by clicking, and anything you do by clicking, you can be tricked into doing this way. So it's a little scary.
Okay, so the rule is, if you tell us about scary things, you have to tell us how to fix it.
Yes. Okay. In the long run, the fixer... The browser manufacturers are on the case. Adobe are on the case. Flash 10 is going to add in some code into the administrative interfaces so that they will detect if they're running inside a frame and then not run. So that way you can't do things like turning on the camera by having it inside a hidden iframe or anything like that. It won't be perfect protection, but it'll certainly help a lot if those kind of admin things can't be done nastily. But ordinary web pages is going to be very, very hard to defend against by any fix in the browser because iframes have perfectly legitimate uses as well. They're a perfectly legitimate HTML tag. So you can't just say, well, I know the problem is we'll remove all iframe tags because then stuff like Google Maps, if you have a Google map embedded in a web page, that's done with an iframe. So the iframe is Google's site and the rest of the page is your site, that kind of thing.
Oh, I see. So they can't get rid of that altogether. But
they can't get rid of all of that. But yeah, there are a couple of things the browsers can do to make this a little more secure. So they're working on that. Flash are working on fixing the admin interfaces. So when Flash 10 comes out, you definitely want to update to that quickly. And any browser updates that come out, well, you should always do browser updates, but you definitely want to do them this time.
Okay.
But that's sort of more long term. And that's not very immediate, and that wouldn't be security light.
Yeah, we're not allowed to just lay awake worrying. We have to have some positive action.
So if you want to take some affirmative action immediately, then you need it's a three-step plan. Step one, start using Firefox. Step two, download the NoScript plugin. And step three, configure the NoScript plugin correctly. And then you're more protected. So I believe we have briefly talked about NoScript before, haven't we?
Yeah, I don't think we ever got into the why you would want to use it, but we didn't get into the how to actually configure it. And that's something I'd be interested in, because I loaded up NoScript as soon as you told me about this, but it's got all kinds of yellow banners and cryptic things and allow this and disallow that. And I don't really know what to do with it now. I'm just sitting there going, oh, I'm scared.
Okay, well, what NoScript allows you to do is it allows you to take control of what it's... Its origin is in JavaScript. It started off as a way of controlling JavaScript. So in the olden days, you had a sort of a binary choice with JavaScript. Either you have JavaScript or you don't. And that's not very useful, because if you turn it off completely, loads of sites stop working. But if you turn it on completely, you're putting yourself at ridiculously unneeded risk from loads of things. So you wanted some sort of in-between between always on and always off, because neither of those are good options. And NoScript evolved as a way of controlling JavaScript on a site-by-site basis. So it would used to just block JavaScript, and then if it had blocked some JavaScript, it would put up a little menu at the bottom that would list the different websites that were trying to run JavaScript on this page. You can include JavaScript from different sites into your current page. Again, Google Maps, that kind of little thing when you have a little Google Maps widget, or any of those little widgets will tend to suck in JavaScript code from elsewhere, which is why I think on your site you have quite a few different sources showing up.
Right. And not that I ever intentionally added any of them, though.
Yeah, well, they're all part of the various little widgety things like Amazon, stick one in, and that kind of thing.
Right, right.
So NoScript will just list off all the different domains that are trying to run JavaScript on a page, and you basically can whitelist or blacklist domains. Anything you whitelist, it won't annoy you about again, and it will just let it at it. Okay. Anything you blacklist, it will disallow everywhere and won't annoy you about it again. And then the other option you tend to get is to allow once, which does exactly what it says in the tin.
Okay, but so when we go to podfeed.com with NoScript on, there's 16 separate menu choices here.
Yeah, Podfeed is an example of a site with an awful lot of that JavaScript being sucked in from different places. If that's a site you visit regularly, then you know you may need to take some time to approve and disapprove each one. But you have to remember, this reminds me an awful lot of turning on... I can't remember the name of now. There's a great firewall product I always used to use, Zone Alarm, that was it, in my Windows days. And for the first week or two of running Zone Alarm, you're constantly dealing with pop-ups from Zone Alarm where you're saying, hello, what do you want me to do about this? What do you want me to do about that? What do you want me to do about this? And after a week or two, it settles down because Zone Alarm has learnt your pattern. NoScript will do the same.
Okay.
But what they've also added, and I've been using NoScript for a long time, and it's become much more polished. So they've added two features that make it an awful lot more pleasant. First of all, they've added an option that says temporarily allow all of this page. So if you're going somewhere you don't usually go to, you don't have to sit there worrying individually about each individual thing. You just say, yeah, I'm going to trust this page. And you say, temporarily allow everything here, and it just gets out of your way.
So now you'd only want to use that if it were something you knew to be legitimate, like you're going to CNN.com, yeah. But you don't usually go to CNN.com. Yeah. You just felt like it today. But
MSNBC and those kind of places tend to be really heavy JavaScript users, and you just can't actually browse around there without JavaScript.
Okay.
So, yeah, I use it on that kind of site. Or often on various blogs and stuff I follow, there'll be links to news items from local city papers in different parts of America. And, yes, I'm interested in that one article, but it's not a place I plan on spending regular time, you know. So yes, something interesting happened in Seattle, but that's not likely to happen again for a while kind of thing.
So that's a case of where you wouldn't try to teach NoScript what to do about that site.
Yeah, just get out of my way. Shoo.
Okay, but so I'm still confused.
There's still another cool feature.
Okay.
That gets it out of your way. So It also blocks, as well as blocking JavaScript, it also blocks Flash by default, which is really handy. But Flash is used for a lot of videos embedded within the web page, and having to go through and choose whether or not you trust Vimeo or whatever is really annoying. So it puts up a little box that says it's blocked something. Just click on that box, and then it'll say, do you want to allow this chunk? And you say yes, and it'll let everything that it needs to play that video. Which is a new feature as well that didn't used to be there. I don't think it was there last time you tried this.
That sounds kind of like one, FlashBlock, where FlashBlock just gives you a little arrow.
Yeah. This isn't as nice of an arrow as FlashBlock, but yeah, you just click on the bit that it's blocked and say, let it at it. So then the other thing is
Hang on, Bart, back up. I've just tried going to vidler.com, and I thought, okay, I'm going to see what it looks like. It's telling me I don't have Flash.
Okay, click on it. Click on the big blank box.
I don't have a big blank box. It says, this website uses Adobe Flash Player 9. Download Flash now.
Okay.
It's not
right,
letting
that's
me
the
do
website.
Anything.
That's the website being too smart for its own good. The website there is running SensingSort. It's trying to run some JavaScript to prove that you have Flash. But of course, you have JavaScript turned off. So it's going, oh, you clearly don't have Flash. So in that case, you're going to have to work through the little script menu at the side.
Okay, the same thing's happening at YouTube. So what do I do?
Okay, so the little script menu say, allow YouTube.
Oh, okay. So you just globally allow that. Okay.
But yeah, that YouTube is certainly one you're going to bump into all the time.
Yeah, but that also means it's not going to block. One of the things I do like, okay, YouTube's a good example. I do like the fact that with FlashBlock, a lot of the ads you see are little Flash videos, and I never have to see those, but I just click on the ones I do want to see. So I kind of wish they weren't being too smart for their own good.
Yeah, but again, most of the ads don't tend to come from a trusted domain. They tend to come from advertising-specific domains. So I tend to see a lot less ads than other people because I have JavaScript disabled on domains I don't trust.
Okay, little update here. I said allow YouTube, and it's still telling me I need Flash Player. Now it's saying allow ytimg.com.
That's another YouTube. YouTube runs off a whole bunch of subservers. That's another YouTube server.
Okay, now I have video. Okay, but without you on the phone here, I wouldn't have known to accept ytimg.com.
It's true. It's not a perfect solution because it pushes the responsibility to you. So it's not a tool that magically does anything. To NoScript, NoScript doesn't make any sort of judgment call on the quality of the JavaScript. It just lets you decide. It just tells you what JavaScript is trying to run and lets you choose whether to let it run or not. The decisions are still being pushed to you. So,
but I'm not qualified to answer those questions.
Well, you are and you aren't. If you're going to known places on the web like YouTube, then it's reasonable to trust whatever YouTube sends your way. It's when you stray off the beaten path that you should always think twice.
Okay.
So a link from an email, for example, would be certainly somewhere where you would not want that to do anything automatically without you choosing to let it do so.
I see.
So it stops you accidentally straying into the wrong part of the internet and getting walloped over the head. Is really what it does. And that's not a bad way to go about it, because trustworthy websites are low risk, whereas, you know, the outback of the internet is high risk. So if you're only vulnerable to the low risk, then you're a lot safer than if you were vulnerable to both.
Okay. So what about all these options? I mean, I went into options
okay.
and there's like 17.
Let's go into the options, because if you click on the little S sign, you get an options dot, dot, dot. That pops up another thing. So the tab you're interested in is plugins.
Okay. I'm looking at
so here you'll see the default options. So you see things like forbid Java, which is a very good idea, as the security stuff we were talking about last week shows, Java can have lots of nasty security flaws. Forbid Adobe Flash, forbid Microsoft Silverlight, forbid other plugins, and forbid iframe. The forbid iframe will not be checked by default.
Okay.
That's the one you need to check in order to protect yourself from this clickjacking.
I got you. Okay, if anybody hears... I can't tell if you can hear my snapshots going, but I'm taking those right now just so I can add them to the show notes.
Okay, well, that's in my blog post, actually.
Oh, okay, great.
Something that's important to note, this clickjacking is not a JavaScript exploit. It's only using CSS and these iframes. So just using NoScript is no protection, unless you go in and check the little box to say forbid iframe.
Ah...
You have to do that.
Okay.
It's very unusual, actually, for something on the web not to require JavaScript.
So wait a minute. If I forbid iframes, does that mean when I go into Ustream now, it's not going to work?
Yeah, but you can re-enable them on a site-by-site basis.
Okay, so when I go there and it doesn't ask me, I need to go into the options
it'll come up under the S. It'll be one of the things that's now being blocked. So it says additional restrictions on untrusted sites is the heading here. So once you trust Ustream, none of these restrictions apply anymore.
Okay.
So you're forbidding all of this on untrusted sites.
All right, so the NoScript options are not globally. It's globally unless you told it to do something else.
It's everything you haven't whitelisted.
Okay,
we're killing all of these features.
So this whitelist, that there's a tab in NoScript. There's a that says whitelist. What's in the whitelist tab is anything I've said. Trust this.
Allow. Yeah. Okay. So that list will continue to show. So it should now contain YouTube and that YTIMG or whatever, and anything else that you've said allow.
Okay.
And so, if at any stage you change your mind and you don't actually want to allow it anymore, you can remove stuff from that list. There's also a blacklist. Which is stuff that you mark as untrusted. And none of those things are ever allowed on a blacklisted site, even if you allow everything else from that page. Stuff that's blacklisted is just never let, ever, which is kind of handy. But I only have that done on annoying ad stuff. Double click. I've just told double click to get lost forever.
Right, just as a general rule.
Yeah, pretty much.
I hate that everybody's having to learn as I go, but this is part of what I wanted to talk about.
Yeah, sure.
I went back into options on podfeet.com, and I said allow podfeet.com, and now my Amazon ad has gone away. It was there, and now it's gone. It has a big snaky script thing with a red thing through it.
So if you click on the S again, there should be an allow Amazon.
But that was there before. I thought so I have to allow every one of these.
What would have happened there is that perhaps the Amazon thing is using the NoScript tag to decide what to do depending on whether or not JavaScript exists on your site.
Oh, okay.
Once you allow JavaScript on your site, that NoScript tag ceases to the other thing.
Again, being too smart for its own good, it was saying, you're not allowing JavaScript, so I'm going to give you this instead. And then when I said, I am allowing JavaScript, it goes, but you're not allowing JavaScript for me. Now I can't go.
Yeah, so it tries to do its JavaScript thing, and then the JavaScript thing tries to go off to Amazon server, at which point NoScript goes, I'm sorry, but Amazon are not on the good boys list.
I see. Got it. Okay, now it's also got allow WordPress.com. What on earth? I don't. WordPress.com is the site where you can host your WordPress blog, but I don't host my WordPress blog there. So what's WordPress.com doing in here?
Something in your theme is obviously trying to phone home to WordPress for some reason. Because it doesn't come up in my blog.
Interesting. And now, by the way, now that I allowed it, I've got good grief. Now that I allowed podfeet.com, a lot more stuff is showing up. Now it wanted to know, was it okay to run Google Analytics?
Yes, Google Analytics is another one of those things that senses whether or not JavaScript is on. So while you had podfeet disabled, Google Analytics went, there's no JavaScript here. Fair enough, I'm going to put up a PNG or whatever. Whereas now that you've enabled JavaScript, Google Analytics has gone, excellent, I'm going to take out the big guns. Google Analytics is one that you should make a decision on either to allow or disallow.
Well, in this case, it's what I use to gather analytics on my website. So
basically, it's up to the visitors of, you know, do you want, as you go around the web, do you want your visit to count to all of this website owner statistics, or do you want to invisibly browse everyone's website? And it's a one or all. But no, I mean, if you don't mind being counted, then enable Google Analytics.
Right, but what are the chances people are going to go out of their way to let me count them? Please let me count you.
Yeah.
So there's another one in there.
Really. Google Analytics, it will constantly be popping up. So if you don't allow Google Analytics, you're going to get lots of those yellow bars. So I can tell you it wasn't long until I said, allow Google Analytics.
And it doesn't hurt anything. It just gets us statistics on hit rates and, you know, what countries are visiting us and all that sort of thing.
Well, no, the hit rates will still get counted even if you block the JavaScript. But it gives Google Analytics the ability to show you what browsers people are using, what screen resolution they have, all of those cool features.
And by the way, to the audience, those are important. Martin, I've been arguing about whether I should be allowing people to view my site from IE6 and things like that.
Well, so. Not allowing. I'm not being that draconian. I'm saying you should ignore IE6. Well, no, I said not going out of your way for IE6. If stuff breaks in IE6, it's IE6's fault.
Yeah.
IE6 is old, dead, and very, very broken.
But anybody who's using IE6 is using it because someone else is making them. Nobody would voluntarily be doing that. So I feel bad for those people.
Yeah, and a lot of people are using IE6 because, well, the internet still works in it, so why change? Well, no. The internet doesn't work for it if you come near any of my sites.
Right, right.
It's a very, very, very broken browser, and the sooner we can ignore it, the sooner web development becomes more sane, because IE6 is responsible for massive wards of insane people in hospitals.
All right. Well, I think we've probably dug into this as far as most people could stand, or possibly much further than most people could stand. But I have a better idea. I can now go
Hang
to
pod. On.
Oh, wait. There's more about it? Oh, step three.
Well, no, that was step three. Was configure it. But there's another very useful piece of advice I've seen given by a couple of security professionals. If you're doing something very important, something that you want to be really secure with, use a separate browser. Now, that's hard to do on a Windows machine. Well, it's easier now with Chrome, actually. But on the Mac, Fluid is very much your friend here. Set up a separate Fluid app for anything that's sensitive. Then you'll never be logged into it in your browser, so you can never be tricked into messing with it.
Wait a minute. So if I make a Fluid app out of Firefox, how...
No, not out of Firefox. Out of a site that is very important. Like your bank or something.
So talk us through that again. I'm not following you at all.
Fluid is a site-specific browser, so it's effectively an entirely separate web browser. It doesn't share where you're logged in, where you're not logged in. It doesn't share your cookies. It doesn't share any of that.
Oh.
It's entirely separate. Therefore, if you always use a Fluid app for the really, really sensitive stuff and never log into it from your main browser, then if someone does try to clickjack you, they can't get at the really sensitive stuff because it's not logged in that browser.
Okay, I did not understand that at all. I thought that was just a tricky way of double-clicking to go right to a site. That's all I thought it was.
Well, it does that too. So it separates it out so that it shows up differently. You can have a separate icon for it. You can have it in your dock as completely separate. You can Apple Tab to it completely separately. But it is a little web sandbox. So anything you do in there, you can log into one Flickr account in one... Fluid app and log into a completely different one in another Fluid app, because each Fluid app is self-contained.
Okay.
The side effect of that is that if you log into stuff, if you have a dedicated Fluid app for your really sensitive stuff, then none of those login credentials exist in your normal browser. So you can't be fooled into clicking on stuff that you don't realize you're clicking on those sensitive sites.
I had no idea it did that. That's excellent.
Yeah, it's a nice side effect. It's not really its main goal, but it's something it does, and it's really handy. So I actually have a lot of Fluid apps at this stage. I find that a great solution.
Now, I forget. How do you actually make a Fluid app again?
You download a program from fluidapp.com, I think. It's fluidapp.something anyway.
Okay.
we looked that up for the show notes.
Right.
So you download it, and then you run the little app, and it gives you very few fields to fill in. The URL that the app should go to, where on your file system it should save it, which is usually your applications folder, and what icon you'd like to use.
Huh.
And you click go, and that's it.
Well, even I ought to be able to follow that. this is one of those things where I hear about things, but until I'm really motivated, it's just kind of like, that was interesting. But learning how to actually use it. And it is fluidapp.com, by the way, so we'll stick that in the show notes too.
Yeah, no script you can get by going to tools... add-ons and then saying look for more add-ons, or you can go to noscript.net.
Right. That worked for me. Okay, now are we done with NoScript?
Yeah, so just the short version is... Actually, yeah, we're done.
It is sometimes good to do that final wrap-up, but all right.
It is sometimes good to do that final wrap-up, but I think we've beaten this one to death.
Okay, so now that we've eaten our fruits and vegetables here, our broccoli and our Brussels sprouts, we had something fun to talk about, right?
Yes, I've finally gotten an iPhone. There's a photograph I'm going to get you to stick into the show notes, which is the iPhone next to my old phone. And I'm not entirely sure how old it is, but I know for a fact I've had it longer than my partner, and we've been together for nearly 5 years. And I know that the model goes back to the last century because I've had two of these. One of them got lost or stolen, I'm not entirely sure which, and I replaced it with an identical one. So I know it goes back to before the year 2000. It is a horrible old Nokia brick.
So sleek and a nice interface, good looking then.
Yeah, actually, it's one of the. It has a colour screen, but it's a really, really old colour screen. Those ones where if there's even the slightest bit of sunlight, you have to cover your hand over the screen and sort of peer at it.
But it seemed to dial phone numbers, right?
Exactly. It made phone calls and did SMS text messages. Apparently, it could go on the internet, sort of, kind of. Apparently.
Well, I actually called it using Skype accidentally once when I got off on the time zones and you were still on your bicycle, as I recall.
Yeah, that was one of the times when... Actually, that's going to happen again soon, isn't it? When you guys switch the daylight saving time before or after us
and
the rest of the world.
Confused for weeks and months. It's going to be... It'll be chaos.
Yeah, it's chaos twice a year. All because you guys insisted on being awkward.
Oh, I could kill someone.
I just dropped my old phone.
All right, so one thing I noticed, as soon as someone gets an iPhone, now all iPhone talk is more interesting, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, for me, changing the iPhone wasn't the same sort of, oh my God, this is a world changer, as it would be for other people, because my iPod Touch didn't leave my side. And I got it the day it came to Ireland. I got it on day one. So I've been an iPod Touch user for ages. So, you know, all this touchscreen and all the coolness and, you know, the email, the web, none of that is news to me. So getting an iPhone wasn't that kind of experience. For me, getting an iPhone was literally like taking my iPod Touch and my cell phone and merging them together.
Right.
So the only thing that's new to me is the phone functionality of the iPod, or the iPhone, and the form factor, which is significantly different. It's an awful lot thicker. An awful lot it's significantly longer. Quite a bit wider as well, actually. I'm holding the two of them side by side here. And an awful lot heavier. I didn't used to know I had my iPod Touch in my pocket, but I know I have an iPhone in my pocket.
I noticed that the first time I picked up an iPod Touch, I couldn't believe how thin it was. That was really, really shocking.
Yes, like I've picked up a business card, haven't I? Oh, wait, no, it is an iPod. And the new ones apparently are even thinner, because I obviously have a first-gen one, which is for sale, by the way. Although I think Peter in work has first dibs on it. I think he was interested in getting that off me. But as well as, obviously, the shape and size, it has a glass touchscreen instead of the plastic one on the iPod Touch. And I have to say, I feel the difference. It feels so much nicer to use, and it seems to be more responsive.
I didn't realize they had a plastic screen on the iPod Touch. On the first gen?
They certainly do on the first gen, and I don't know about the second gen. I don't own one.
Interesting.
But yeah, they do. And they scratch a lot easier than the iPhone does, because it's plastic, obviously. And it doesn't feel as smooth. When you run your finger over it, it has more resistance than the iPhone does.
Hmm.
Now, maybe it's that more resistance that it's just a teeny, teeny... It's not sticky, but it's less unsticky. I don't know if that makes much sense.
No, not at all. But the result is that you said you find it much more intuitive to use, or it works?
Well, no, it's equally. It's just a teeny little bit more accurate, and that feels so much more reassuring.
Okay, yeah.
It just feels better. It's like going from a Lada. I don't know if you have Lada cars over in America.
No,
but they're made in Eastern Europe, and if you slam the door, you'd be afraid the one on the opposite side would fall off. Going from a Lada to a Rolls Royce, you know,
just that.
Not quite that extreme, but it just, you know, it's like a good car when you hear the door close, it makes a solid thunk.
I heard,
you know, that sense of quality.
Right. I've heard they do spend a lot of time making that noise be what you expect and hope it to be.
Yeah, apparently they do, yeah. So it feels that much more quality, and it is more accurate.
Now, it wouldn't be like Bart to say only nice things about it, though, right?
Oh, no. Other things that differ on the form factor are, the two big differences really are where the sleep-wake button is and where the jack is for the headphones. And both of those are very much steps backwards.
Hmm.
When you hold when you're right-handed and you hold an iPod Touch in your hand, the finger next to your thumb, whatever one that's called.
Index finger.
Right, naturally rests right up where the sleep-wake button is on the iPod Touch, which is where the headphone jack is on the iPhone. The sleep-wake button is right next to your thumb when you're holding it, actually, and it's actually very awkward to get to it. You really have to do some contortion with your fingers on the iPhone.
Are you talking about the big round home button?
No, the sleep-wake button.
What sleep-wake button?
The silver one on the top.
Oh, okay. You can do it with either one. You can do it with the one, but the big round button wakes it up too. Either
yeah,
one.
Yeah, but it's putting it to sleep is important to use the right one.
Oh, okay.
Before I put an iPod Touch or an iPhone in my pocket, I always click that button.
Okay, the sleep button as opposed to the wake button. They both wake one,
it's
only
officially
one sleeps.
Called the sleep wake button.
Okay.
That's its official name.
What did you do, read the
Stevie.
Manual?
I may have stumbled on it or something.
Okay, well, if you're going to be Steve, you got to call it iPhone, not the iPhone then.
No, I'm not getting into that argument. That annoys me no end. Anyway, so, I don't know, you pick it up and try it for yourself. Your finger naturally goes to right where the headphone jack is, and it's actually a little bit of effort to get to where the sleep-wake button is, whereas on the iPod Touch, it's completely natural. It's
see, I think I'd go the opposite way on that. I always hold my iPhone with my left hand because I type with my right hand. So my left hand, it would actually be very
so you multitask? You're actually multi-touching and typing all at the same time?
Well, I'm just saying I would hold it with one and type with the other one. I can't hold it with the right hand because then I would have to type with my left hand and I'm right-handed.
Actually, I'm right-handed too, but I always type with my left hand.
Really? Oh, you're just backwards.
It's I'm weird. You know, actually, I place Nurkro with the wrong hand as well for being right-handed, so maybe it's just me that's weird. But yeah, for me, the iPod Touch worked really well and it really annoys me that it's so awkward.
Oh, okay.
And the other thing is that on the iPod Touch, the headphone jack is at the bottom, whereas on the iPhone, it's at the top. And
I think you're
bottom,
just getting into what you're used to. I think you're picking on just things you're used to. Yeah.
No. At the bottom, right, cables hang down. Gravity works downward. So if you have something coming out of the bottom and gravity is pulling it down, it's out of your way. It's gone. It can never get in front of the camera, which doesn't exist on the iPod Touch, or the screen. When something's coming out of the top, down is in front of your bloody screen.
Are you saying that you would be taking a picture with your camera while you had your headphones in?
Well, no, but the screen is more important. I don't really care about the camera. I tweeted about it and someone tweeted back saying, and the camera, so they obviously had problems with it.
I don't take a lot of pictures while listening to my iPod. That seems kind of strange. But why not just have it go behind?
Well, it'll go whichever way it wants to go. It's quite an annoying cable, actually. It's quite thick and grumpy. So I have to say, when I first got the iPod Touch, I thought it was bizarre having it at the bottom because every iPod I'd ever owned had it at the top. And after a day or two, I went, ah, ha, 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 ha.
Wait a minute, the Nanos have it at the bottom.
Do they? I don't own a Nano.
Ah. Well, at least the first and second gen did.
Okay. No, I've only owned an iPod Photo before I got my iPod Touch.
Oh, okay.
It just lasts. It's still going. These things don't die. Touch wood.
Yeah, they definitely they don't. They go forever. I still have my 60-gig iPod Video. It lives in my car. That's my car iPod.
Cool. Mine's 60-gig iPod Photo. Anyway, but I find it's a lot better at the bottom. It's a lot more sensible. Now, I presume the reason it's at the top on the iPhone has something to do with making room for all the various bits of internals.
Yeah, and there's the dock and all that sort of thing.
Well, the dock is in the bottom of the iPod Touch, too.
Hmm.
But no, the iPhone at the base has the speaker and the microphone.
Okay.
So if they're there, there obviously can't be a jack there.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
So I think, considering how small, the iPhone is bigger than the iPod Touch, but there's so much more in there with cell radios and GPS receivers and speakers and microphones and all sorts of bits and bobs. So I would imagine the reason it's at the top is quite simply down to an engineering choice.
Right. Now, move on to the last thing you complained about, because this one I actually agree with you on.
Actually, there's two more.
Oh. Wine.
Yeah, I know. Every phone I've ever had, when you lock the keypad, it means that you can whack away at every button. You stick the thing in your pocket and you can whack away at anything and nothing changes. On the iPod, on the iPhone, the little volume buttons continue to work. So if you're not listening to music, you're either making your ringer really, really loud and you're about to blow the ears off yourself the next time someone rings you, or you're making the ringer really, really quiet and you're going to miss phone calls.
Now, I agree with you 100% on that, except for the part where it's never loud enough. So I don't think you'd ever blow your ears out, but I agree.
You and I have very different meanings of loud then, because I consider the default to be too loud. I've turned mine down a bit.
Of the phone ringer.
Yeah.
Now, I think I heard that on the new iPhone, it's a lot louder, because it is not loud at all on the original iPhone.
Well, on the new 3G, it's certainly loud.
Okay. Now, and it's probably because people are missing a lot of phone calls, because I miss calls all the time. I'll have it out on my desk in front of me, but not have noticed that the ringer got turned down, because I never, ever turn that ringer down intentionally, ever.
Okay, well, in that case, it's definitely been changed, because you can be in no doubt that this thing is ringing.
Oh.
let me see if I go into settings here. I can make it make noise, can't I?
I would think so. You go to the ringer thing where you
go to sounds.
Yeah.
And then I get to choose, so I should be able to make it make noise.
Crank it up.
I presume you can hear that.
Yeah, I can hear it real well.
That's the one you mean. I hate that one.
I love that one.
Then you just think you're Steve Jobs.
Makes me happy.
So I went for the xylophone because it's on the other end of the scale. Anyway, stop that. Stop. Okay.
All right. Well, and then I assume also, over time you're going to like other things about it.
Oh, no. I like everything about the iPod Touch I like about the iPhone. So don't, you know, I'm not in any way unhappy. But as a phone, it has some imperfections. The other thing is if you're listening to a podcast, those buttons change meaning and they then become the volume for the podcast you're listening to.
Or any audio.
Or music, yeah, whatever it happens to be you're listening to, which is really annoying as you're cycling along and Leo Laporte is getting louder and then quieter and then louder.
Because you're bumping those buttons?
Because I'm bumping those buttons. Now, I have to say, I don't bump them often, but I have noticed it. Yeah, which is weird and annoying.
Now, you said you had another thing?
The other thing, in a way, it's minor, right? The physical ringer switch, I think, is cool. I think every phone should have a physical ringer switch.
Do you know, it's like three separate menu picks. I have to, on the BlackBerry 8800, I have to enter a password, I have to push a button, I have to do a scroll and select to mute the phone.
Lord.
Oh, it's horrible.
Even on my crappy old Nokia, which you'll see a photograph of in the show notes, you hit the power button, didn't turn off the Nokias. It brought up a menu, the top item of which was switch off. But if you hit the button again, it cycled through the menu and then you'd hold on the option you wanted. So you'd click, click, hold, and you'd be on silent. And just the one button at the very top. So even that was easy.
Yeah,
but the little ringer switch is fantastic. However, there's no indication the phone is on silent. Like, they have a menu bar across the top where I can see my signal strength. I can see that I'm now on Wi-Fi. I can see that the keypad is locked. I can see I have an alarm set and I can see my battery. There is nothing there to tell me that if this someone rings me, now it's going to happen.
Hmm.
Every other phone I've ever had has had a little bell with an X
okay,
that sits up in the top corner of the screen.
Again, the main thing I have to compare to is the BlackBerry 8800, and it has all kinds of little indicators like that, but they're done in a 3x3 pixel icon. So I can't tell if I've got a Facebook message, I've got a voicemail, I'm on mute. I can't tell what any of them are. It's comically small. It's like,
so it says something. You know that there's something.
Well, there may be three somethings and they're different colors. Actually, I'm lying about the Facebook one. That one I actually noticed because it was a little white F inside of a blue circle, and that's the only one I can actually identify. So if you've left a message on my BlackBerry, I apologize. I can't tell if I've got messages.
Yeah, but it's quite a normal thing for a cell phone to have an indicator of any sort. And with a beautiful screen like on the iPhone, there's more than enough room.
Yeah. I don't know where they would put it, though, because, do you put
it... The menu bar at the top, next to the lock icon. The lock icon shows up centered.
Yeah, I suppose.
Loads of room around it.
I'll have to go get my phone and look and see what you're talking about. Well, it'll be fun to listen to you go through and get to play with things like Twitterific on the iPhone and... there's a lot of stuff you're going to be able to do untethered as you used to have to be Wi-Fi to do before.
Well, this is going to sound awfully nerdy, but I was out. It was lovely weather yesterday, not so much today. So I was out on the bike with the camera and I thought, do you know something? I haven't got a good train photo in ages. I wonder what time the next train is passing under Jackson Bridge. So I flipped out the iPhone, went to irishrail.ie, typed in the times for trains from Maynooth to Sligo, which pass under that bridge. It's about 2 minutes from Maynooth. So I said, okay, the train leaves Maynooth at 1627. So if I'm at Jackson's Bridge at 1629, I'll be able to get the photograph I want.
Ooh.
And I did.
Now, did you use the iPhone to find that out?
Of course, because I was on the road. I was out and about.
Perfect, perfect. And did you take the picture with the iPhone or with your...
I had the D40 with me. I was out taking pictures of autumn beauty.
Oh, okay.
But I figured it'd be nice to get a train shot in. So it did work. Now, I'm getting that little E sign an awful lot.
That's what I've heard.
As opposed to that 3G sign. And I have to say, it didn't hold up well. It was okay for web browsing, but I had an email attachment with an image and I could not get it to open.
Hmm.
It would not keep signal long enough to get a 500K image.
Yeah, there is that. You know, one of the things I find most comical, though, right now that people are complaining about the iPhone 3G is that the battery life is so bad. And I find that just so comical because Steve Jobs said, I did not put 3G in it because it's got really bad battery life. That would be really bad for battery life. And everybody pissed and moaned and whined and complained. And he goes, okay, fine, I'll give you 3G. I told you so. He's not saying I told you so, but I am. He told you so. Battery life is supposed to be horrible.
It's no worse.
No worse than what?
It lasts a day.
I think
the old iPhone lasts a day. The new iPhone lasts a day.
Well, a lot of people are saying it's not lasting a day, but it seems to be related to how much you play with it when you first get it.
Well, yeah, I think once you settle into actual usage instead of the demo for everyone who meets you, I think it will last a day very easily. Yesterday, I spent the entire day listening to podcasts on it. I was out cycling. I had podcasts all the way. I listened to four of Leo's shows, so I must have been gone at least 4 hours.
At least.
At least, yeah, if not eight. Right. Well, that seems a bit unlikely. I had it on while I was cooking dinner. I had it on while I was doing the dishes. And I even used the speakerphone. Oh, actually, the speaker I'm really impressed with. Forgot to say that. I even had the speaker on listening to podcasts while I was doing a bit of housework.
Wow.
It lasted the day. There wasn't much left in it by nighttime, but now, I was using it quite heavily.
Did you have Wi-Fi turned on the whole time?
Yep.
And how about Bluetooth?
No. I don't have a single Bluetooth device.
Yeah.
So
I think what people are finding is that if you turn on all of the radios, then you get about 5 hours. So if you pick and choose, but if you don't use Bluetooth, I use Bluetooth a lot in my car, so I got to have that one on. But you can also turn off search for wireless networks or something like that. And turning that off is a good thing because you don't want it searching for Wi-Fi. It'll be going, is there Wi-Fi? Is there Wi-Fi? It'll keep shooting out signals when you don't have one.
Okay, but if you turn off that searching, what happens when you come home and it does have Wi-Fi? Will it find it again?
Yeah, it'll find the one that you've already told it.
So how do I do
it?
That?
I don't have it right in front of me, but if you go into system
settings.
It's
got to be in settings.
Yeah, the system settings, and then I believe there's a Wi-Fi section in there.
There's a general section which contains a network section.
Yeah, it might be in there.
Enable 3G on. Good call.
Good thing.
Well, a lot of data roaming. You can turn off data roaming with a switch. Thank you.
Definitely don't want to.
Okay, so there's a Wi-Fi button. It says Wi-Fi on and ask join networks on.
Yeah, you want to turn ask to join networks off. So that's where it's going to go out and look for Wi-Fi networks that, you know, if you really...
No networks. Okay. Gotcha. Done.
So, if you're going into a Starbucks here in the U.S. and you want to try and get on the AT&T network, you would want to say, search, for, you know, ask to join networks.
Okay,
do it actively. That's not something that's bad to have off. I don't think so. I don't think.
Well, around the house, the 3G signal is disastrously bad.
Well, and why not use Wi-Fi? Because Wi-Fi's
exactly. And you're so I want to keep Wi-Fi
limits.
On.
Yeah.
That reminds me of something that I just discovered, rather embarrassingly, when my boss was coming to talk to me about it. iPhone 2.0 has broken my access to the internet from work.
Oh.
Do you know how happy I was that it was working? It still works on my iPod Touch, but only on my iPod Touch. And if I change any settings, it'll never work again. The little tab at the bottom of the VPN setting that lets you specify a proxy has vanished. Now, my iPod Touch doesn't display the proxy tab, but it's clearly still using the one I had entered before I upgraded to 2.0.
Oh, interesting. But if you change anything, you wouldn't get it, huh?
Yeah, but I can't see what I have set, and I can't edit what I have set, and on my new iPhone, I can't set it.
You know, I think I'd do some searching around on that, because that sounds like something that might just be a mistake or a little...
It sounds like a bug, and I did search around, and the Apple news groups are full of people going, no solution. So I went to the Apple feedback page and gave them a frank opinion.
There you go. And I'm sure they read those very, very closely. All right, we've been
rambling. What made it embarrassing is that my boss had come to me and went, does the iPhone work on our network? And I said, yes, so we bought one.
Oh, no.
And then he says, I can't get it to work on the network. Can you show me how? And I picked up his iPhone. I went through the settings. I went, the menu item's missing.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and now I have the same problem. But anyway.
All right. Well, hey, we've been rambling on a long time, and I do appreciate you taking a little extra time with us today for reasons that I will explain in the show.
Yes, but you did say, you made a very big mistake. You said to me, it's okay if we go long.
Yeah, as I will have explained at the beginning of the show, is that I hurt my eye over the weekend, and so my ability to type and read is pretty limited, so I figured we'd go for extra chit-chat since it's a little easier than typing stuff up. So appreciate you coming to the charge there, Bart.
I know, it was fun, because I have to say I was quite looking forward to having a good chat about the iPhone.
Good. All right, well, I think I'm going to wind us up there, though.
Okie dokie. I won't be talking to you next week because I'll be at a wedding, so it'll be 2 weeks.
Uh-oh. We'll have to figure out what we're going to do about that, but are we still going to be happy here?
Yes, we still have happy computing until the next time, whenever that happens to be.
All right, bye, Bart. Well, I sure hope to be in full form by next weekend. I really did miss the chat guys this week. Like I said, it was lonely. I do have to tell you, I'm really excited about the laptop announcement that Apple is going to make, or should I say notebook announcement, because they don't want you putting them on your laps because they know that you're going to burn yourself and they don't want to be liable for that. But anyway, I'm excited about the laptop announcement for next week because my MacBook Pro is getting pretty long in the tooth at 2 years and 10 months old, doing all the recording that I do and the flash video for the live show and all that. It really needs a refresh, that's for sure. So if you're going to be checking out the Mac Roundtable podcast for next weekend, I guarantee you if they came out with a new MacBook Pro on Tuesday, there will be one in my hands, and I will be talking about it on the Mac Roundtable and probably the NoSillaCast as well. Well, if you want to contribute to the show, especially with the dumb questions, we haven't had any in a couple of weeks here, shoot an email over to me at nosillacast@podfeet.com, and you can include an audio recording if you like. I love them if they're between about 3 and 5 minutes, something along that line seems to be pretty popular with the crowd. If you want to follow me at Twitter, check me out at twitter.com/podfeet. I'm rarely brilliant, but I do like to have a lot of followers there. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.